That's cool.
Thank you, just cool.
Yeah. Okay, can we just start? This is paper 1A, 62A for FASB. There's not any decisions required here, but we're going to be asked questions. Sandra.
Okay, thank you very much, David, and I'm sure we're all looking forward to a live discussion on insurance now that we have impairment. Agenda paper 1A is clearly just only educational purposes here. You don't have to make any decisions. We had a discussion in February, one that was on not allowing day one gains, and you already seen some examples how we could unlock the margin. This paper that you have in front of you, some of you have read them like the third time maybe. It was already presented at our insurance working group last week on Friday, so this is exactly the same thing. Okay, unlocking the margin. The comment letters and all our outreach people we met tell us that we should unlock the residual margin. It doesn't make sense that we have all the cash flows, the risk margin, the discount rate to be remeasured every reporting date, but having this residual being unlocked. They say, well, that's just inconsistent with the measurement on day one and day two, and it's clearly counterintuitive that you might have a loss from a contract and on the same time allocating this kind of profit margin. When we look at unlocking, we need to remember that the board's already reached two decisions that have an impact on the residual margin. One of them is the acquisition costs. So we're now looking at acquisition costs on a portfolio level. In the exposure draft and the discussion paper was incremental on an individual contract level. So more of those cash flows are already in the measurement of the liability, so the residual margin should be smaller now. And the same should hold true for the cash flows, because we're looking now at cash flows that are directly attributable to the insurance contract. So the liability is already a bit bigger, and the residual margin or the composite margin smaller. When we look at unlocking, first of all, why did the board decide not to unlock in the first place? It's because we said, well, remeasuring in the truest sense doesn't seem to be feasible, because the residual margin has several components in it. One of them is profit, others are kind of maybe services, uncertainties in the measurement, and so on. So it doesn't seem to be feasible. Okay, when we look at unlocking the margin, we have three layers of the decision, or three steps. First of all, you need to decide if you want to lock in or unlock. That's the first decision. And the second one is consume or flow. This is what is described in the paper. And then the third step is, for what changes do you want to unlock? But let's go through the three steps first. Lock in or unlock. If we're looking at, we want an accurate measurement on day one, and this is our whole objective, then the necessary logic to that is that all the changes afterwards on day two should go directly to the profit or loss. But if we think that the residual margin, composite margin, is something like allocating profit, then it would be maybe more reasonable to adjust the margin and to unlock. We have to be clear about, if we unlock, that also means that profits are, or the changes in the liability, in the cash flows, maybe in the risk margin as well, all those changes are deferred and smooth if we unlock. We need to be clear about that. Okay, that's the first decision, lock in or unlock, what you prefer. And if we look at unlocking, we need to decide if we want to consume the residual margin, which means that all the unfavorable changes in insurance contract would adjust the residual margin. The favorable changes in the cash flows would go through profit or loss. And that could maybe be a bit of a skewed presentation, because you're showing your profit or loss, the good changes, more profits that you expect from that contract, but the bad ones are adjusting the residual margin. The other approach would be to float that residual or composite margin, which would mean you adjust them for both the favorable and unfavorable changes in the insurance contract. And when we float, I think the third step is very important here. for what changes do we want to unlock? Is it really for all changes, which would be a pure smoothing, deferring of the changes? Then some would say, well, adjust the margin for financial changes. If we do that for financial changes, so changes in the discount rate, we would maybe cause an accounting mismatch with the asset side when the asset side is valued at fair value, because the fair value changes go through profit or loss. And if we would adjust the changes in those financial inputs for the liability, that would cause an accounting mismatch because it's shown in two different sides, not in the P&L. So what the staff thinks at the moment, it would make sense maybe to unlock the residual or the composite margin for non-financial changes, which are like morbidity, longevity, and risks in the insurance contract. Those are the drivers of insurance risk, we would say, but it doesn't impact any accounting mismatch. The fourth approach I want you to consider is that we could distinguish between changes that refer to the current period, so you're pretty sure in that current period something happened, you have a loss, and you want to show that loss in profit or loss. But your expectation about the future changes as well, and those changes to the future assumptions could adjust the residual margin. So, and this approach could be coupled with the one before, let's say you change for non-financial changes for referring to the future, for example. And the staff thinks that this approach is most consistent with the measurement on day one because the residual margin is allocation for referring to the future. So if you adjust for other future changes, they will be consistent with day one. Okay, so that would be the unlocking and the approaches we could choose. Two more things on that. If we adjust the margin, we need to be sure that, or need to be clear about if we want to adjust retrospectively or prospectively. Retrospectively, with catching up all the changes or the allocations you've already made since inception, it's the natural approach. This is what would be consistent with IAS 8. You go back to the point at inception and allocate accordingly. But we need to be clear, and I think that's what we heard from the working group as well. This is especially burdensome. It needs a lot of administrative efforts, and we're not sure if it's worthwhile. So some of the staff would think that a prospective adjustment would be worthwhile doing and would be enough. The fourth point I want to mention is that we had the decision in February that we don't want day one gains. But we haven't decided on day one losses necessarily. And what we still need to decide if the composite margin, and we would say the residual plus the risk margin, should not become negative. Okay, maybe a quick catch up on what the working group discussed, because it discussed exactly this paper. My feeling was that the working group members were in favor of unlocking the margin. Maybe most of them would say floating. They say, well, this residual composite margin should not become negative. Some would favor to float it for all the changes. And some mentioned that it could be a huge administrative burden if we need to apply this unlocking retrospectively or maybe at all. It might not be helpful. And it could be very complicated. And I open this now for your discussion. Thank you.
Can I get in when possible?
Okay, John, go ahead.
Just a question. At the educational session last meeting, the presenter from Australia mentioned that they did some unlocking. I think it was on the longer term. Could you tell us how they do it, to what extent they have systems problems, how well it works? Is that some information you have?
Okay, I can give you an overview. I won't go into detail because I would like to give the opportunity to Australians if I'm wrong in this. But they do unlock for life insurance. They unlock in the sense of floating, as described in the paper. They unlock only for non-financial changes. And what they do is also discussed in the paper, they distinguish between effects that are, should be shown in the current period. So they show something in the profit or loss if it's, it refers to the current period, and they adjust for future changes in the residual or in the margin, as they call it. But they do have a different allocation pattern of the margin.
And is there a systems issue in doing that? Because it sounded like you thought there might be one in doing it when you made your presentation.
Well, they adjust prospectively as well. So they don't apply this unlocking retrospectively. And I haven't heard of a major administrative burden.
No, in fact, this is Warren. Tony Coleman indicated that they have quite a lot of experience now. That standard's been in place for quite some time. They I think, have various procedures. I'm not sure to what extent these are documented procedures that assist in that process. But he said it's well understood, and it doesn't present issues to them in terms of practical application. And he's also offered to provide further information for us if we would want that in view of any decisions we make in the future.
I'd like to make one other point, or maybe just confirm. I understood when he said that, he said that they did not have a risk margin for that piece. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a composite margin in Australia. Mind you, John, the Australians strongly supported, though, explicit risk margin in the comment letter process.
But this seems to be working pretty well.
Yeah, in terms of the unlocking of the residual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they it's a composite margin for life. We're only talking about life insurance in that sense. For general insurance, they have an explicit risk margin that's separate.
Thank you, Warren.
Welcome.
Paul, you want a question?
Sandra, I just have a question. I find the unlocking something maybe worth pursuing, but I'm not sure for which inputs. And my question relates to paragraph 35, which deals with the non-financial inputs. And you say that it would make the measurement of the liability respond to changes in interest rates. Why? It wasn't clear to me why that would be for the non-financial inputs like mortality.
Yeah, Paul, maybe 2 points on that. Sometimes we don't know what the inputs, well, which input affects the other one, and it might be hard to distinguish which input had the first impact, maybe. Let's put it like that. So this is a different issue. So what is really financial and what is non-financial input? This is one question. What I was referring to with the accounting mismatches, and this also is affected because the ED said we need to discount or accrete interest on the residual margin as well. So this is another decision you have to make as well. But if I adjust the margin for changes in the interest rate, then, and I have assets that are valued at fair value, then the changes in the asset side go through P&L, but the changes on the liability side would adjust the liability measurement. So this would be an accounting mismatch. On the other hand, if you have assets at amortized cost and you adjust, well, with the changes in the financial inputs, the liability measurement, that would dampen that accounting mismatch. Sorry if I caused some confusion here, but if we change for financial inputs, we wouldn't be neutral, so there could be potentially an accounting mismatch.
Yeah, I understand that. I just wasn't sure why adjusting for mortality would take care of interest rate changes.
It doesn't. It's just neutral. So the changes on the financial inputs, if we just adjust for non-financial inputs,
well, I think the confusion might be about the adjustment here. The adjustment is talking about adjustments to the residual margin. So whatever happens, the first two or three building blocks are going to be adjusted for changes in interest rates and changes in mortality. What paragraph 35 is saying is that if you take the changes in mortality and use those to adjust the residual margin, then you won't have a problem with accounting mismatch. If you have a change in interest rates if you took it to the residual margin, you'd have a mismatch problem if the assets were a fair value. If you take the interest rate changes direct to P&L, then you won't have a mismatch problem if the assets are at fair value.
Okay. Very good. Thanks.
Senator, one thing I'm not fully followed, when you report the working group members' view, that is, what's their views on the all or financial or non-financial items?
I think it was... I would say the majority would be in favor of the non-financial, but it's also according to what the Australians do, as we just heard. Some would say adjusted for all the changes.
I mean, maybe the board members who are there can speak on this as well, but my impression was that people's view on that was conditioned by their view on how the assets were going to be carried, and the people who thought the assets were going to be at fair value would be distinguishing between financial and non-financial, and the ones who thought they're likely to be on some sort of cost basis wouldn't make that distinction.
Yeah, I agree with that, Peter.
Okay.
I would probably phrase it a bit opener in saying those that are very much concerned about volatility have used it as one way to consider whether we can deal with volatility. Those are mostly those that also consider that some of the assets might be at cost and some at market value. For them, it's part of a toolbox to address volatility.
A bit surprised that we mix the discussion with the issue of the assets measurement. Conceptually, the margin has nothing to do with the assets. I can understand it for practical reasons, for dealing with volatility, but conceptually it's a bit strange that we come up with the asset at this point in the discussion. It seems to me the margin is just a difference between a premium and a liability, and so the assets have nothing to do here. I'm a little bit surprised as to why the staff could not come up with a recommendation and just put an open question to us, whereas it seems to me that the way you present the arguments seem to balance come in favor of the unlocking and confirmed by the insurance working group, but you didn't go as far as recommending that. And finally, it seems to me that asking the question at the same time in the system of residual margin and composite margin makes it a bit difficult, because the more you have identified the building blocks and separated the risk margin, the easier it becomes to accept the unlocking of the residual margin. It might be more difficult to accept it in a system where you have not separated the components of this composite margin. So I would not be surprised to hear two different views, whereas you are in the composite margin or the residual margin camp. For me, in the residual margin camp, clearly, yes, the unlocking of the margin is the right solution, provided it never becomes negative.
Well, I think just quickly, because I think we haven't had a clear question in our invitation to comment on the exposure draft, recording on do you want to unlock or unlock, and all the people told us you should unlock, but they didn't tell us how. So this is why we thought we need more input.
If I could just follow up on what Sandra said, there's a number of reasons that we didn't phrase an explicit question in this paper. First of all, this paper was posted before the insurance working group meeting, which was only last Thursday, so we didn't want to tie down before we'd had the benefit of that discussion and heard what people wanted to say. We didn't want to preempt the conclusions that meeting would make. Secondly, we're planning to bring in the near future a paper which has come up in the discussions a few times, which discusses one board member's analysis, which might bring the residual and composite margin approaches closer together. And again, we didn't want to try and tie down this question until we had the benefit of that discussion. And thirdly, we think what you do with the residual margin depends very much on what the outcome of the discussion on whether or not there should be an explicit risk adjustment. And to us, it made sense to ask the question once we had made that decision. So you could ask why we bothered to bring this paper at all, and as Sandra said, we didn't have a question in the invitation to comment. There's a number of issues. We just thought it was worthwhile airing those issues and having board members think about it in advance.
Can I say something?
Yes, the second time. So you want to get something directional out of this? Is that the idea if we're writing the papers?
Yeah, can I just add as well that we discussed that with the board advisors, I know, a week or two ago, and they strongly recommended that we should get input from the boards as well before bringing it back to a decision-making session.
Tatsumi?
To David, so several questions to Sandra. I think at the insurance working group meeting, there are support to the floating method. So and regarding floating, I think the sort of the method, do you have any method how to calculate the floating? And especially that the calculation of the day one and subsequent calculations, do you think that we can apply the same calculation method for initial and subsequent? And also the unit of account must be cohort basis, but do you still think that in the floating calculation should be based on a cohort basis? Yeah, that's the questions.
Well, thank you, Tatsumi. I think as we cannot remeasure the residual margin because we don't have a second market transaction, we won't have exactly the same measurements on day one and day two. It's just if we want to have this one locked-in margin that's going to be allocated somehow, or if we want to adjust that margin. So I think that's the decision you have to make. The cohort level is important for the allocation of the margin because if we say, well, we want to make sure that all of this margin is really allocated over the life of such a contract, we thought it's necessary to go down to a cohort level from a portfolio level to be, well, to can use the passage of time for the allocation to make sure that it's really allocated in its entirety. If you look at portfolios, they're running for longer than, well, they have maybe an average duration, but they run for a longer time, and it's not easy to figure out if we really allocate all of it over the life of the contract. So it depends on what you decide on the allocation if we still need the cohort level.
But Sandra, if we focus on the only non-financial input, in that case, so we can grasp the change in the non-financial input only for cohort basis? I'm not quite sure.
Well, I don't know, but I would say it's feasible. But that's just me.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we've got a few more people wanting to speak, but Leslie, do you want to bring FASB in at this stage?
People have questions? I have a question. And Sandra, are we okay to go toward the back of the paper, or, you know, in other words, okay, thanks. So if I'm looking at the summary of staff views in paragraph 45, I didn't hear any change in the summary staff views based on the working group feedback, I guess probably because it sounds like it was quite mixed. But as I understand it, it says that the staff is leaning toward unlocking the residual for estimated future changes and assumptions relating to non-financial inputs for both favorable and unfavorable changes. So in other words, it would flow. First, I pulled out the memo from February where you ran through some examples of this. And the example where you're showing a floating approach related to interest rates, an interest rate change. And I guess what I was struggling with was how, if the recommendation is to float for changes in non-financial factors, how operational is it to distinguish between current period effects and future period effects? So I would personally find it helpful to have an example that works it that way. And then secondly, how does this dovetail with a future paper on OCI? And here's my concern. If this recommendation is unlock for non-financial changes, which is a deferral mechanism. And then the OCI paper says some changes for financial items in OCI. What will be recognized in the current period through P&L? I'm struggling, you know, we're taking a volatile industry and potentially looking at approaches that take the volatility out of a current estimate. So why have the current estimate? Unless I'm fundamentally missing something.
Well, I think that's a very good point. Go ahead.
It'll also be challenged by juxtaposing what we're doing on the liability side with the different options we have on the asset side.
Yeah, my reaction, Leslie, to your question, which I think is a very good one, is that I wouldn't preempt the discussion of OCI at this stage. The staff's bringing forward a paper on that issue, rightly so. But I think, in a sense, it's consistent with the staff's view that some other things need to happen before we take a final view on unlocking of the residual. So I think you raise a very good point.
Other questions?
Well, I think, you know, my reaction, Leslie, to your question is, I think fundamentally we have to figure out what we mean by the performance statement, what we mean by P&L, because even if this gets pushed to the margins, it would still potentially be on the balance sheet, reflected with changes in the balance sheet. But the question is, what goes through the income statement? Is the income statement a current period performance statement, or is it a change in, is it a roll forward of the balance sheet from beginning to end, and thinking about the whole contract as a whole? I think that's a question that continues to come up. We spent the first hour and a half this morning talking about those kinds of issues, and it's just a perennial one.
Other questions? No more questions here, David.
Okay, thanks, Leslie.
David, can I come in when you're ready?
Yeah, okay, Warren. Let's two parts first.
I support unlocking the margin. I think conceptually, to me, it seems the correct answer, but maybe I need more education. I don't know. When we discussed, certainly with regard to the risk margin, when we discussed it, the risk margin was supposed to be there to sort of compensate for the errors in the forecasting of the expected future cash flows, for the uncertainty in those expected cash flows. And it seems to me that when, as we move forward in time, our expectations will change. And therefore, it seems to me appropriate to adjust at least the risk margin for those changes, because that's what the risk margin was for. It was for that uncertainty. And so now we know more and we're adjusting them. And so those adjustments. And so certainly with regard to the risk margin, I would unlock. And I think I would unlock for the residual as well, because that was the profit. So I think I'm definitely in favor of unlocking for the risk margin, and I think I'm in favor of unlocking for the residual.
Two points. I think the staff has done a very good job of balancing the arguments for and against here. I would yield to those who want to unlock the residual margin, so I support that, although for simplicity's sake, I could also live with the proposal that was in the ED. One of the things that I had heard consistently listening to the earnings calls of U.S. and European insurance companies for about a decade is the interest that analysts took in providing information about the current period's results affected by changes in non-financial inputs. It's very, very high on their list. So if the results were better this period because enhanced mortality, better than expected, they wanted to know that, and by how much. if it was because of better lapse experience. They wanted to know that. So in my mind, that strongly argues in favor for providing that information to them and unlocking those types of changes. I would also favor doing this prospectively. Now, I recognize that introduces perhaps a little bit of anomaly between what we're doing day one and day two. That I think is overweighed or overshadowed by the fact that it's complex. It would be costly to do that. So I would argue to do that prospectively. I don't think you lose a whole lot of information content by doing it prospectively. So I think that's also a nice approach here. So overall, I think the staff has listened and balanced the interests of both investors, analysts, as well as the preparer community. And I think this is a very smart recommendation.
Thank you. Warren?
My starting point, David, is not to complicate this model. And I must say, when I saw the earlier paper that had all of these possible different ways of unlocking it, it did frighten me a little and worried me that we were going to make this model more complex than it really needs to be, and that would not be consistent with our objective of trying to improve the understandability of information provided by insurance companies, capital markets. So I could stay where we are in the exposure draft, and that is to just run it off. I think the staff make the point that it's an amalgam of things, so there isn't really a non-arbitrary way of dealing with it, and I could live with what's in there. I could be convinced to allow unlocking, but like Leslie, I'd like to see the whole picture before I'm prepared to vote on that. If I was to support unlocking, it would be pretty much along the lines of what the staff has suggested. I think that it's difficult to make the argument that it should only be a shock absorber if you're going to unlock, so you only allow the bad news to be used to absorb the margin, not the good news. I think retrospectively is just too complex, so it would have to be prospective. And I look at this clearly from a sort of a current perspective, that is that it's a current measure of the liability, and so I would expect that the assets are going to be held on a current value basis. And so if you allow financial items to, or factors to be included in that unlocking, then you're going to, as the staff point out, potentially have an accounting mismatch, which I think we're trying to avoid. So I think the staff have actually developed a fairly strong position in terms of the way forward if the boards are of a mind to actually unlock. As I said, I haven't made my mind up just yet.
David, can I say something?
Yes, of course, that's it.
Right, so thank you, David. So, say this unlocking, especially the direction for floating, I have several concerns, the directions. The reasons why is on the first day, the calculation of the residual margin is it's a sort of the calculation method is just a plug. That means a expected present value of the premiums minus the sort of the fulfillment notion plus risk adjustment comes to the residual margin. So I think day one we can calculate only the say residual method. So that means that we cannot calculate residual margin directly, it seems to me. And the content of the risk margin could be some part is overhead and some other factors. And we do not know exactly what they are, but say to reassess every year end, based on that calculation, it seems to me very burdensome, and as long as we cannot measure directly the risk margins, I think I'm very much doubtful to use the sort of the reassessment every year end. And if we try to use the unlocking, I reluctantly accept sort of the shock absorber approach because the for the simplicity of the calculations. I'm might say, like Warren, I have some concerns about to introduce the sort of the reassessment every year makes this calculation or this model very complicated. So I'm very hesitant to move this direction, but I would like to know the exact calculation and how it is calculated and it is feasible or not. Otherwise, I'm very much concerned about the direction the stuff is heading for. Thank you.
Okay, Elke?
I support staff's direction, which is not to assume recalculating, but floating the margin and taking changes in assumptions against that margin, and I would follow positive and negative. I think it gets you to an economically reasonable result, because otherwise you might end with a period loss due to a change of assumption, which is then, well, covered in future periods by unwinding a positive margin. At the same time, I think we need to remind ourselves we are here talking, according to our ideas, about the long-term business only. So it's life and health in most, I would assume, under the modified approach, as we are considering that the margin runs over the coverage period only, that margin is done gone after year one. But as Leslie has said, I would also strongly argue that we need to see the full picture and to see the different components, how we address volatility, and also what conceptually makes sense to be considered against this margin. I tend to non-financial assumptions for the time being, but we need to see the full picture first.
I agree with seeing the full picture. I agree with the staff recommendations in 45 and 46 if we were to choose to unlock the margin. I think that's the way to do it. But, of course, we can't decide yet, I don't think, whether we should unlock the margin because of points that other people have said about the other components in the model. To my mind, there's only a certain number of sensible combinations of all of the different things we're discussing, whether it's unlocking, measurement of a risk margin, whether there should be a risk margin, OCI, asset values, presentation, in other respects. There are several different moving parts, and it's not a case of there's sort of 100 different combinations that work. There's only a small number, I think, that do work. My actual preferred combination wouldn't involve unlocking the risk margin, but I have a feeling that my preferred combination might not be the one that we go to. So I would be willing to unlock the margin as long as it made sense in the context of the overall model.
Okay, I must admit I wasn't very keen to unlock the margin. When I saw this paper, I was really quite surprised because this is quite a shift from where we've been before. And I always looked upon certainly the residual margin as the plug to stop you having day one gains. But if we had given you day one gains, all the other changes presumably would have just flowed through. So I really wasn't quite happy about suddenly changing this as well. I think it's going to get horribly complicated, this. If you're going to do it, I tended to agree with where the staff came from. But I must admit, I wasn't wildly enthusiastic about doing it in the first place. Okay, shall we?
I think he's still there.
Sorry?
He wasn't where you are now.
I don't believe I prefer not to unlock. John,
can I make a comment?
Yeah.
I didn't like the risk margin to begin with, and I thought early on when we talked about unlocking that there was a view that if we unlocked the pressure on the risk margin and that difference, risk versus composite, would diminish. I'm not sure this does that. Like some others, I'm not sure I understand fully how this would work. Clearly, the non-financial piece, as it relates to cash flows, I know what you're doing, but you also have the risk margin itself. And if we're keeping that, is there a non-financial piece there that also gets unlocked in? I just don't know how it works. So I'd like to understand it better. But I started from the point of view that if this was a way to bring both boards closer together, that this would be worth doing. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I know that it does that, though.
Anybody else on the phone wants to comment?
David, I just can I just mention, David, I've got to leave at 4:30 in case it continues on beyond then.
Are you sure, Warren?
I'm positive.
Maybe we can make some decisions when he's gone.
Ah, now that would be a change, let me tell you.
Okay, well, should we just take the staff really just want some direction where you think the balance might lie, and I think overlying this is the question that Leslie raised and several others since, how this all fits together. But can we just get a feel of where you think at the minute you might want to go? You can't obviously make a decision. It's just, where's your sympathy lie? I mean, that's probably it. So could I ask the ISB, who would support the unlocking? Could we go through the phones? There were seven here. Steve and I didn't vote for it. Daryl?
I would not support it.
Okay. John?
I'd absolutely support it.
Okay. PK?
A reluctant yes.
Okay. And Warren?
At this stage, I would not support it, but that will be subject to what I see down the track.
Nine four. Okay, there's four against 9-4. Could I, just before Warren disappears, Warren, where are you on the proposals that the staff sort of suggested? I gather from what you said earlier that you'd broadly support them if you were to unlock.
Yeah, that's the direction I would go in, David.
Okay. Does anyone disagree with the staff proposals generally here? No. Anyone on the phone disagree with what the staff are recommending if we do go to unlocking?
I generally support it. I'd like to understand it better.
Yeah, sure, I understand that. It's just, we're only talking about sympathy here. Okay. David,
what is the question? I missed it.
The question is the paragraphs 45, 46, Tatsumi. Do you sort of broadly support if we unlock?
No, I have a concern about 46A. So it's a Stevens issue, I think, that to put, A said the board should prohibit the residual margin plus the risk margin from being negative. I'm not sure whether we should include the risk adjustment or not.
Hmm? Okay, but sticking with 45, you're okay with 45? Okay,
45, I'm not quite sure 45A, so I'm very skeptical about what is written in here. I can't hear you.
Tatsumi, are you in a submarine?
Sorry?
Never mind.
I'm in a submarine, 45 A on the 46.
Okay, thank you, Tatsumi. We voted broadly in favour, tentatively, obviously, of the unlocking, but we have concerns about how it would all work, possibly in favour of the staff recommendations. Could we let them go first?
I think we had not anticipated that we'd be voting today. I guess, would anybody, given what sounds like a fairly strong majority on the IASB, would anybody like to express any support or initial lack of support for that, just so the staff has a clue where we might stand at this point in time?
I was like you. I want to. While I was sympathetic to some of the issues raised by the staff in this paper, I am not ready to even remotely be able to vote for this until I understand how it fits into the whole model. It affects income statement outcomes.
Others?
Tom Scott.
Yeah, I would take it a step further personally and say I'm unlikely to support this. I'm very, very concerned about all the smoothing mechanisms that are being put into this model. And that, you know, I think refreshing on the examples, this is a deferral mechanism. And I really struggle with why, if we don't want to have the effect of changes coming through the model, why are we setting up an approach that appears to be a current measure? I think there's way simpler ways, if that's where we want to go, and I'm not suggesting that's where I want to go, but I'm just pointing out that it seems very, very complicated. Anybody else? Okay, that's all we have at this point.
Oh, thanks, Leslie. I must say I agree with you. Philippe?
I think we're rushing a little bit on this last part of the discussion. I think we spent a lot of time on the principle of unlocking, on the how-to. There are many issues, there are many questions. In paragraph 45, 46, we have a series of choices to be made, and we may say yes to one element and no to the other one. Personally, I would say okay for floating the margin. I would say okay for having a floor, such as the margin cannot become negative. Now, on the decision as to which element would be unlocked or which element would be neutralized through the adjustment of the margin to make a special case for non-financial inputs as opposed to financial inputs, I think we need more discussion, and we need, as Tom said and as Steve said, we need to have a more general view of the model before we can make such a decision.
Okay, all we've really said is that there seems to be a slight balance, at least for exploring this further in the direction of unlocking. Some of us don't like the idea at all, but that seems to be the majority, and we can't really say yes or no until we see how it all slots together. Is that sort of fair summary?
Yeah. And I think when we come back to this, one of the questions we will be asking is whether to. I just think that the examples you've had in the previous meetings and some of these considerations will be important to you. If we come straight to say whether, you'd have asked us how. So now that we've asked you how, you're asking us whether.
To the FAS board members, as I understand, most of the FAS board members, may all of them favor composite margin. And if they not favor unlocking, whether means you lock the composite margin at all?
Yeah, I'm not sure where our board stands at this point. You're right that the majority supported the composite for the DP, but you know, we've had significant turnover on the board. I really don't know where people stand at this point.
We will be bringing a paper also forward that has an adjustment to the formula for the runoff of the composite margin, also with principles of when you would speed up, slow down, or how you would adjust that composite margin. So that is still being, will be brought to the board in the training.
Okay, any other points? Andrea, do you want just to give us a brief update on the working group?
Sure. The insurance working group met last Thursday on the 24th of March, and some of you were there. We had 22 members and alternates, 5 official observers, 5 ISB board members, 1 FASB board member, and numerous staff attending the meeting. We started the meeting with an overview of the meeting papers, and in that session we allowed the working group members the opportunity to comment both on the ISB's work plan in general and on the progress in the insurance contracts project in particular. In the room there was a general sentiment that it was time to bring the insurance contracts project to a close after 14 years of discussing the issue. The members of the working group also raised some issues that we didn't discuss directly in the papers for that meeting, for example, on transition and on participating features. We've, of course, yet to discuss that with the board, and we indicated that we'd be likely to come back to the working group for input on those topics in the future. We also had a discussion and noted the benefits that we would gain from sharing drafting with insurance working group members as early as possible in the process. For the main agenda, we discussed only three topics to make sure that we had ample opportunity to hear all the views that needed to be heard on those topics. On the discount rate, we discussed the board's tentative decision that makes explicit that both top-down and bottom-up approaches are permissible. And there was general support for the flexibility that this clarification indicated. There was also a consensus that most would probably use an asset-based starting point. As before, we noted general support for market-based consistency where possible and entity-specific inputs when market inputs were not available. We heard some concerns about identifying the adjustments that need to be made to the discount rate, especially in how it applies to assets other than bonds that may be held to back insurance contracts. This, for example, real estate and equities. And we intend to clarify some of these issues with the boards in a future meeting. Finally, we noted comments that the rate that would be determined would inevitably, it would be subjective, and there would be an important role for disclosures in providing some comparability and transparency around that. On presentation, we discussed the presentation both of volume information based on the paper that you had at the last joint board meeting and on volatile information, and we tried to get the working group members' input on the things that they would find useful. So many would consider the source of earnings analysis useful, and we had a continuation of the ongoing debate about whether that information should be on the primary statements or as disclosure in the footnotes. Some wanted to be able to see the entity's expectations, how performance varies against the expectation, and a sensitivity analysis about the expectations. There was also support for some notion of operating. We noted we would be unable to define operating profit for just insurance contracts, but we did hear some support for excluding parts of the changes of the insurance liability from operating. In spite of that, most said we shouldn't do this in an overly prescriptive way, but we should rather allow companies the flexibility in deciding what they thought ought to be excluded. Most believe that the use of OCI would be important, if not actually crucial, in presenting volatile changes in the insurance liability. And most also believe that the solution would rely on how the presentation of insurance liabilities interacts with the presentation of assets held to back those liabilities. Some suggest that this doesn't need a change to IFRS 9, and we're interested in exploring an approach in which the effects of changes in the discount rate are disaggregated into a part that's presented in profit or loss and a part that's presented in OCI. At the March meeting, you discussed some example presentation formats, and you specifically asked us to obtain input on which of those examples, which presentation approach, would be most useful to users and most practicable for preparers. We're exploring that externally, but we also put the question to the working group. And there was general support for some combination of an expanded margin approach that was, it was the 4A appendix, I don't know if you remember it, from the meeting last week, and also with the combined with the ability to disaggregate information to exclude from operating part of the changes in the insurance liability, so that you'd get insurers able to present some sort of subtotal along the lines of profit before tax and then changes in financial market estimates. The third topic was on the residual margin, and as Sandra has said, we discussed whether and how the margin might be unlocked. I thought that, in general, insurance working group members supported unlocking the residual margin. Some were vehemently supportive, some were moderately supportive, and some were slightly concerned about the complexity that might arise. But the main driver there, again, was this idea that residual margin represents profit, and there's counterintuitive effects that if you recognise deferred profit and something makes that profit unlikely, it doesn't show. We discussed the relative costs and benefits. Again, concerns about complexity and the consequences, which we heard in this room, also arose in the working group meeting. There was also a plea that the board should keep it simple, if at all possible, and that applied to more than just the residual margin. We asked for feedback on the board's recent contract boundary decisions and indicated that we would be likely to be seeking feedback on some of the board's decisions over the coming months, specifically on some of the board's decisions, especially those which were different from the ED and DP. We also reported next steps. There's going to be a sizable package of papers for the next meeting as usual, and we also indicated the possibility, the now strong possibility of holding another meeting in May.
A quick question on this outreach you mentioned. What is happening and what is the timing of this? We said we should look for analysts, both industry and non-industry analysts' views on certain things.
We've written to or emailed all the users who wrote us comment letters, who have met with us in outreach meetings and who attended the roundtables to seek their input on that. And then we also used the insurance working group. We raise it also in the ongoing outreach as it comes up. I've asked for initial input by the beginning of April, which would give them another 2 days. Obviously, if something